I'm Tim Gombas, and this is Faith Improvised. It's a podcast where I can think out loud and talk with friends about things that interest me. Books, films, sports, music, culture, politics, the wonders and complexities of being Christian in this world, and my academic discipline, biblical studies. You're welcome to email me at faithimprovised@gmail.com, or you can leave a voice message at the podcast homepage on anchor.fm. In this episode, I offer a few reflections, recommend a brilliant book on the history of the United States, and I continue the series on the Ungospel of Mark by talking about some of the fascinating narrative dynamics of what is going on in chapters 4 through 8. But first off, just a handful of random observations. Over the past week, the Dodgers won the World Series. So good for you, Dodgers fans. Happy for you. And a really odd baseball season basically comes to a conclusion. But it's pretty satisfying that this year, the best team won, especially given the fact that over the last several years, the Dodgers have lost to the Astros. They lost also to the Red Sox several years ago. And it appears that for sure the Astros were cheating. And it is almost certain that the Boston Red Sox were cheating as well. They were stealing signs in a way that sort of went beyond what the rules allowed. Now, I'm always, I just think if you can steal signs without breaking the rules, what's wrong with that? This is one of the best things about sports, about anticipating what the other person is going to do, anticipating what the other team is going to do, and trying to suss out what pitchers are going to throw you. And if you could figure that out, good for you. And if you can, you know, if you've got a runner on second base who's relaying to a batter signs or where the pitch is coming, that's great. That takes unbelievable mental skill and communication. But the Astros and the Red Sox beat the Dodgers through some special subterfuge that involved actually breaking rules that had been established against electronic communication when it came to relaying signs. And so the fact that the Astros were eliminated in the American League Championship Series and that they never made it to the World Series was really satisfying, felt just. And the fact that the Dodgers, who've been one of the best teams in baseball over the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, finally broke through and won it, felt really good. So good on them. In fact, one of the interesting episodes in baseball over the last several years is that last year, the Nationals faced the Astros in the World Series and had a whole bunch of countermeasures so that the Astros could not steal their signs. That's so cool. I mean, it's just fascinating to see what they actually had to go through to hide their signs from being stolen. That is, catchers telling pitchers what pitch to throw, and they switched up their signs from inning to inning so the Astros could not cheat, could not figure things out. I don't know. All that kind of inside baseball stuff to me is absolutely fascinating. So there's a bunch of you Dodgers fans that do listen to this podcast, and I couldn't be happier for you. Secondly, there was some really interesting sets of reflections in the New York Times from yesterday. So today's Monday, November 2nd. And in the New York Times each week, we get the Sunday Times here at the house. And my favorite section is the Sunday Review, which is where all of the various opinion columnists write. And I really enjoy really good reportage, which the New York Times does have, despite what some people think. It's one of the excellent papers in our country. And I also enjoy reading opinion pieces from the left and from the right, from conservatives, from liberals, from Republicans, and from Democrats. They have a great collection of people that write various reflections coming from a variety of angles, publish a good number of my favorite scholars that I enjoy reading about, not only in religion, but also in American history. And this is the section that I go to and usually devour every week. And in this last section, they had a really interesting collection of columns focused on a single theme, which happens every once in a great while. And they were pondering what had been lost over the last 4 years of this recent presidency. And I was really struck by a piece that Michelle Goldberg wrote, who lamented just the loss of mental space and mental energy and creativity that she would normally have given to creative writing and creative reflections, which I thought was really fascinating because this resonates with what I have found uniquely challenging. Now, I've made no secret of the fact that I think that the current president is not only uniquely and spectacularly incompetent, and on that I agree with nearly everyone who has worked with him over his life, but also nearly everybody in his administration who has some skill in their job and then has worked with him, found out that he's spectacularly incompetent and corrupt, and then has left the administration to then talk about it and warn the nation. So not only do I think he's unbelievably incompetent, I think he's one of the worst humans in public life. And I think he will have done incalculable damage by the time that we actually understand just what has unfolded over the last 4 years. And hopefully that's the only 4 years that he holds the office of the chief executive. But one of the unique realities about him, one of the challenges that he presents is his absolute shamelessness. I mean, it really is staggering. There's nothing so foolish, so classless, so ill-considered, and so rash that he will not do. In fact, it seems that if people who are wiser sort of warn him off of certain things, he takes particular delight in actually doing it. He's pardoned soldiers who have been convicted of war crimes over the objections of the entire military, including all his advisors, and some senior officials resigned over what he has done. And like I said, he seems to take particular delight in that. And there seems to be a certain kind of a logic at work in his doing that. And that has to do with the effect that it has on other people. And I think I sort of figured this out a few years ago. It seems to me that he has this absolute and insatiable need for chaos and disorder and madness and everything that goes along with that. That demands that everyone pay attention, because people who are, say, good at their job, or people who are responsible to comment, everybody has to pay attention to that because it's so outrageous. And it doing things like this demand that people focus all their attention on him. And for him, that is the whole point. The whole point is not the common good. The whole point is not what will be good for the greatest number of people, what will extend rights and liberties and freedoms to the greatest number of people with the least amount of negative side effects. I mean, this is sort of an approach that politicians typically take, who actually care about doing good. None of those things weigh on him. He's simply and only and completely and totally an attention hog. And that's it. It does not matter if you are angry at him or you are delighted in him. The only thing that he seems to care about and that his behavior is oriented towards is having your thoughts be about him. And that has been a real challenge, especially if you have any kind of concern for people who are on the margins or people whose lives can be affected by how things go in the public realm. That's a challenge, because how do you sort of pay attention and advocate and support others whose lives might be made more difficult? And how do you end up going through days and weeks and focus on other things like friends or family or community or creative writing projects or things that are fruitful and life-giving, when there is, in the most consequential office in this land, somebody devoted completely and totally and only to chaos? And that, for me has been the challenge of this era is to somehow hold on to sanity, to maintain a posture of being a person who wants to speak well of others and does not want to be consumed with anger. That's such a challenge. And at the same time, to find a way of appropriately expressing revulsion at someone whose words and behavior are morally outrageous, especially for an occupant of a political office that is so consequential for so many people. Just for example, just recently, his refusal to release funds for people devastated by wildfires in California, just because he doesn't feel that he's been appropriately lavished with praise, which is simply insane. Did the same with Puerto Rico, which still has not had power from hurricanes that it experienced several years ago. There's just no interest in helping out because the political leader in Puerto Rico will not lavish sufficient praise on the president. Just madness and unspeakable cruelty. So I found that it's been a struggle to maintain equilibrium in the midst of this era. It's been a struggle to maintain joy. I've tried to speak in as plain terms as I can possibly find. I try to speak plainly about any and all political figures, to be plain spoken and to identify things accurately without exaggeration or without emotion or without becoming a person filled with anger or without becoming a person who will simply level insults. And, while attempting to not bait others into dispute or contention, but to share ideas and to ask questions of others to draw their thinking out. Very honestly, for the most part, when talk about national politics comes up, I've just tried to change the subject, especially when talking with people who regard themselves as supporters of the president, a posture which I think is profoundly problematic. Personally, I don't support any figure. You know, I'm not sure that that's necessarily a wise thing to do. I think it's completely fine to vote for this or that party or figure. I think in many ways that is responsible citizenship. But to take that on as an identity, like I am a supporter of this person, that's how I identify myself. I think that's a problematic way to identify oneself, because then it closes down the possibility of identifying shortcomings in that person or in that party. And you end up sort of taking a defensive posture, which I think that's not so good, because you won't necessarily be honest when a figure or a party backs a policy or a position that is untenable or unwise. Anyway, it's felt like a fight over the last 4 years for mental balance. And it's almost, I felt like it's an act of defiance and rebellion against these larger powers that are trying to draw our entire culture into a descent into madness and anger and resentment and rage. And just as one very small act of rebellion, I simply do not say the president's name, because I don't want him consuming my thoughts. I want to think about other good stuff, about how this season in West Michigan, at least, has been the most absolutely gorgeous color season that I can remember. And to notice the beauty of the changing light. All the particular beauties and sensual delights of this season and of the various seasons. I think we can lose sight of those when we're just wrapped up in anger and rage. So it's for me, it's been a defiance and rebellions against the forces driving our country and our world apart. For me, simply to attempt to love others and to seek to hold on to sanity by being honest and by speaking as absolutely plainly as possible. I want to tell you about a book. The author of this book is Jill Lepore, and the title of it is These Truths, A History of the United States. It's published by Norton, and Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard University. This is sort of a rarity. That is, it's a one-volume sort of sweeping history of the entire United States the last, you know, 400 or 500 years. And for me, this is one of the most insightful and interesting books that I have read in the last couple of years. It's one of those volumes that truly, when I sense that I'm sort of more than halfway through the book and I'm coming to the end, I just get really depressed. I don't want it to stop. It's brimming with helpful and insightful analysis, and not only sort of retelling familiar episodes from American history from a new angle of approach, but also bringing to light loads that I had never considered. The heart of the book is Lepore's setting forth of the project to sort of live out and build a nation on the principles of human equality, political equality, natural rights, and a fearless dedication to free inquiry. And the title of the book obviously comes from the Declaration of Independence, in which Thomas Jefferson asserted that these truths were held to be self-evident, that every man was created equal, etc. Well, the nation has never really lived up to those ideas. I mean, it was built on slave labor. This land was inhabited by white Europeans after having driven out its first inhabitants through war and genocide, slaughter, and betrayal, routinely reneging on treaties made with First Nations people, etc. It's a pretty sordid history. Also, women were denied full participation as citizens, and especially black women. So the nation has never really lived up to these ideas, and as she covers each era, Lepore keeps that struggle before the reader. You know, the ideas that the nation has set for itself, but yet the battle to sort of somehow live up to that and spread equal enjoyment, equal rights, and equal enjoyment culture-wide. As I said, it's brimming with insights because it doesn't whitewash certain episodes in our history, and I love that sort of work. It's sort of an exercise in fearless truth-telling, and I love being hit with perspectives and angles of approach that I had not yet considered. So I find it really helpful, especially as I inhabit an evangelical Christian orbit and culture because of my job and because of the people that I know and love and teach. But this subculture that I inhabit has sort of become an enclave of some of the worst impulses in American history. Racism, white supremacy, patriarchy, white nationalism. And it's very helpful for me to see how these impulses sort of pass through different eras over the last few hundred years, and to see the movements and the cultural dynamics that have shaped the culture wars that are basically threatening to tear the country apart these days. And because the culture that I inhabit, American evangelical culture, is caught up into the culture wars, is sort of pitted in them, I want to have as much light shed on that as I can, because I want to know what it might mean for me to be faithfully Christian in this current cultural moment. So I could hardly recommend this book highly enough. It's one that I honestly could not put down. Like I said, I was bummed to have finished it. Might make for good Christmas reading. A reread, it would be one of the two or three books that I've reread recently, so loaded with insights. The book is by Jill Lepore, and it's called These Truths, A History of the United States. Get it from an independent bookstore. So, I've been doing this series on the Gospel of Mark, calling it the Un-Gospel of Mark, because as I've discovered in my study of Mark's Gospel over the last 5, 6, 7 years or so, it really is just this fascinating, wonderful, beautiful, interesting, insightful, provocative gospel, but it is not at all the gospel that you might have expected to find. And as I said before, the Gospel of Mark has sort of been regarded in a bewildering sort of a way in the history of the church. It's not been regarded well. It's not been treated extensively in commentaries like Matthew or John has, and it's sort of seriously looked down on, sort of the also-ran of the four Gospels, which is really unfortunate. I've had a blast with it. As I said, my commentary in the Story of God series is coming out in the next several months, apparently late February, early March, hopefully earlier. I have no idea. Who knows what is going to be happening in our larger culture over the next several months. Hopefully I will see it in print someday and could die a happy person. But it's coming out and I'm really gratified and pleased about that. And I've just learned a ton from my study of Mark, and so thought I would just love to revisit it, some key aspects of it, in on this podcast, share them with you. And so today I want to talk about the dynamic that unfolds in Mark 4 through 8. And I hinted at this in the last episode. And just to catch us up to speed a little bit and review, in Mark 4, 1 to 20, Jesus tells the parable of the soils. And for the way that Mark composes his gospel, that parable is going to form sort of the frame for regarding the whole rest of the gospel, and especially, a number of elements. Jesus's words in verses 11 and 12, where he talks about, he says to his disciples, "To you has been given the secret of the kingdom, but to those on the outside, everything is said in parables, so that they will end up hearing but not understanding, so they will be seeing but never perceiving. Otherwise, they would repent and be forgiven," which is an absolutely striking and arresting statement of apparently hard determinism and anti-evangelism, which raises all kinds of fun and interesting questions. Because Jesus really is the anti-evangelist in Mark's gospel, constantly telling people not to talk about him. Anyway, we'll bring that up at another point. So Jesus says this to his disciples, and as I indicated, what is going to unfold over the course of chapters 4 to 8, but this dynamic continues all the way up until the end of the gospel, is that the disciples, that is, that there's a group of 12 men that Mark calls the disciples or his disciples in the gospel, and those 12 end up being the people who are constantly and increasingly confused at everything that Jesus has to say in the rest of the gospel. And quote-unquote outsider characters end up seeing and perceiving, and they end up hearing and understanding, and they end up behaving as disciples, which is one of the dynamics that is supposed to alert audiences and readers to Mark, readers of Mark, that in Mark's gospel, the disciples are not being disciples. And in Mark's gospel, other characters are disciples. That's one of the things that we're supposed to take away from this gospel, which is a very interesting unfolding dynamic. And as I've said, I think narratively, one of the reasons that Mark does this is to put church audiences, put the target on church audiences, to have them raise the question, to raise questions for them. Do you really understand what Jesus is all about? Do you really, really understand what the kingdom of God is all about? Are you being welcoming communities for people on the margins? Are you being communities that serve those who are in desperate need? Because that's what being disciples is all about in Mark's gospel. Other impulses like quests for power, quests for prestige, quests for cultural approval and prominence, those are all indications of satanic enslavement. And as I've said in my study, just discovering these dynamics in Mark has just constantly made me sit back in my chair and just ask, what in the world is going on? Because I personally am the inheritor of a subculture in the United States of America that is completely wrapped up in quests for power and prestige and cultural approval and crowds and influence and impact, all that kind of stuff. And that is the subculture of white evangelicalism. So I've kind of indicated this before. Mark's gospel has really kind of shaken me up because everything that you have assumed is up is down. Everything that you've assumed is black is white. And everything that you've assumed is safe is unsafe, is highly precarious. And everything that you thought made a person an insider makes somebody an outsider. And all the things that you thought, I thought, make somebody an obvious outsider for Mark, that has no bearing at all on their status. And they very well could be the ultimate example of an insider. So that's one of the dynamics that's going on that is launched by Mark 4, 1 to 20. That is initiated. That narrative dynamic is initiated throughout the rest of the narrative. And Mark invites audiences to track with that and follow along with that. The other impulse that the narrative impulse that is initiated in Mark 4, 1 to 20, or I should say an other, because narratives are notoriously open, wonderfully open, to a range of dynamics that could be going on, and loads of beautiful gaps and open spaces that elicit our imaginations to do work to add to meaning. But one of the other impulses that is launched here is in the actual description of the four soils. And I mentioned last week that the three poor soils are basically indications of what the disciples are going to be behaving like in the rest of the narrative. They're the ones for whom Satan has snatched away the word when the word goes out. And I said that was Peter when Jesus says to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan," because Peter knows that Jesus is the Christ, but he wants to go to the nation's capital and seize power. He doesn't want to go to the nation's capital and have Jesus die. What kind of sense would that make? Parenthesis, which raises all the questions about evangelical craving of political power, to want to go to the capital and have influence, an impulse that Jesus regards as satanic. Close parenthesis. What are the other soils? The one where the word springs up quickly and then dies away because of persecution, because of the word. Again, that's the disciples. When Jesus is going to be arrested, they take off, they flee. And finally, other concerns entering in, the thorns choking out the word, these other concerns, the anxieties of this age, concerns about other things, and the deceit of riches creep in and choke the word. And again, that's the disciples. Judas wanting money instead of loyalty to Jesus, and John and James being concerned with positions of prominence when the kingdom comes, etc. And finally, we have the good soil. And the good soil is found in unexpected places in the rest of the narrative. And I want to talk about some of those in this episode today, because in Mark 4 to 8, we have a range of surprising characters that indicate that they are good soil. And they're anything but good soil when you sort of regard these characters against the backdrop of the first century world and how Mark constructs them. So we have to be ready for surprise. In fact, one of the best authors on the Gospel of Mark from, I would say, a previous generation, but I don't want to insult anybody, but he's somebody who passed in an untimely way. But Donald Jewell, J-U-E-L, has written a number of works on the Gospel of Mark, and he talks about Mark being a master of surprise, and he is. He's just he's a provocative, playful narrator. He knows what he's doing. But we see these characters as this section unfolds. And the section that I want to focus on today is a section of text that I indicated is a cohesive unit of text last week, and it is formed by the inclusio that is formed in Mark 4, 11, and 12. There's the statement from the prophet about seeing but not perceiving and hearing and not understanding. And then a very similar statement that actually comes from Jeremiah and not Isaiah is repeated by Jesus in 8:17. And when you have an open and a close of a section of text like that, narrators, they don't have lights, they don't have visuals, they have words. And the way that they send messages to audiences and readers is through devices like this, and we call it an inclusio. It opens and closes a section of Mark's gospel. So there's a section of Mark's gospel that runs from Mark 4:1 basically to 8:20. And there are things that happen after that, outside of that text, that are that resonate with what's happening within that text, but there's just some uniquenesses within this stretch of text, and I want to talk about those in this episode. So Jesus tells a number of other parables in Mark chapter 4, but I'm not going to talk about those. He tells a number of parables, and they come to an end in verse 34, and then it's back to narrative. And the first thing that happens at the end of chapter 4 after these parables is Jesus crossing the sea. In fact, like I said, in Mark, one of the things that holds Mark 4 to 8 together is that loads of stuff happens around and on the Sea of Galilee, whereas before this, Jesus, Mark had set Jesus and the disciples up there in Galilee, but not by the sea. And after this, Jesus and the disciples are going to head toward Jerusalem. So there's nothing necessarily significant about the setting other than the setting is consistent in Mark 4 to 8. It's around and on the sea. And as I said last week, that's Mark takes the opportunity to actually construct Jesus's character as Yahweh, the creator God of Israel, the one who has mastery over the sea, which is really fascinating and comes up in a number of shocking kind of ways, surprising ways, and really fascinating ways. But this initial episode the last episode of Mark chapter 4, Jesus is going across to the other side, and there's so hard not to touch on so many aspects of so many interesting details of the text here. But Jesus is going to go to the other side of the lake, and Mark says, leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. And then he makes this interesting comment. There were also other boats with him. Fascinating. Who are those other people? And there are going to be two or three more comments that Mark is going to drop in the rest of the narrative throughout the rest of the gospel that are just like that. There are the disciples, and then there are these other people. And later in Mark, in chapter 9, John is going to make a comment about those other people to Jesus, saying basically, hey, look, Jesus, it's just us 12, right? We heard about these other people doing stuff, and we'd shut that baby down because it's just us, right? Which is another provocative way for Mark to sort of skewer followers of Jesus that imagine that they are the only ones, that they are the faithful ones, and others need to be sort of, you know, need to conform to their way of doing things. We, whatever our tribe is, we're not the only ones. Jesus is a bigger reality than can be captured by any one tribe or tradition. Anyway, we have to hold ourselves, take ourselves a whole lot less seriously. Anyway, in this episode, Jesus is crossing and a massive storm breaks out on the sea, and Jesus is in the stern sleeping on a cushion. Lot of resonances here with the Jonah narrative, although I don't know exactly if Mark intends to sort of draw any conclusions from that. I think just in a lot of ways, biblical narratives are often written in terms of other biblical narratives. They just, sometimes they resonate, sometimes details are repeated because the ways that we tell stories end up being similar. Although maybe Mark is wanting to draw some sort of resonances with Jonah. Remember, Jonah did not want to go to Nineveh because he was afraid that if they repented, that God would forgive them and restore them, or just relent from the calamity that he had sworn he was going to bring. And here Jesus is going to Gentile territory. So maybe there's an undoing of the Jonah impulse here. I don't know. That's hinted at. It's in the background. Anyway, this that comment just brought up because of a comment my friend Marcus made in an email. We're getting together Wednesday. I'm looking forward to the conversation about that, because this lies behind a number of episodes in Mark, just as it does in the other Gospels. There are all kinds of scriptural episodes, that is Old Testament episodes, that lie behind how New Testament episodes are constructed. When are they pregnant with meaning? When are they not? Well, these are open questions for interpreters. Anyway, you can just sense the Jonah dynamics behind what's happening here with Jesus asleep. Well, the disciples are freaked out and they wake him up. They say, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" And he got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. And fascinatingly, he says to the disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" Now, that is another dynamic that we're going to find runs through the whole of the Gospel of Mark. This opposition between fear and faith. And amazement plays an interesting role in the Gospel of Mark, because sometimes a character or the crowd will be amazed, and it's a good amazement. And sometimes it's a bad amazement, but fear is almost always bad. In fact, there's only one or two times where a character is afraid, but then presses through and actually has faith. We're going to see some of these in chapter 5. But in this instance, the disciples are only afraid, and then they are terrified in the end of the episode, and they say, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." And this little episode just cries out for explanation. And it seems to me that what's happening here is the disciples were not wrong in waking Jesus up necessarily. That's not why he rebukes them. And I don't even think that they're necessarily wrong for being afraid or fearful. But I think the reason why Jesus says, "Do you still have no faith?" is because in some way he expects them to calm the storm. And I know that that sounds outrageous, but thinking back to the whole larger stretch of the biblical narrative, going back to the very beginning, it is humanity that was given authority to subdue creation. And with Jesus here present among the disciples, and being the agent and the initiator of the power of the kingdom of God, there is kingdom power fully present for the disciples to act, to actually have dominion over creation and to bring it into subjection so that it is not chaotic. Anyway, I think that that's what's happening here. And I think that this is an initial episode in which the disciples, the 12, are going to manifest themselves as being those outsiders, the people that don't get what Jesus is all about, which is really fascinating. But anyway, this is an initial episode. Right at the close of that episode, or I should say that episode closes with the arrival of Jesus and the disciples on the shore of Gentile territory. They're in the region of the Gerasenes. And I should say, in this instance, this episode in verses 1 to 20 of Mark chapter 5, the disciples are sort of in the background. I don't even think they're mentioned in this episode, except for the first word of the episode. They went across to the lake. They get there to the region of the Gerasenes. And then Mark says that Jesus got out of the boat. And it's really fascinating. A couple of details here. First of all, Mark takes 5 verses to construct this man's character, the demon-possessed man. Like five verses of statements about him that basically load him up as the most radioactively unclean character in the gospel. It's insane. So he's got an impure spirit. He came from the tombs. To me, he's dwelling among the dead. So for a Jewish audience, I mean, oh my goodness, is he unclean? He lived in the tombs. Nobody could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. He's got this sort of superhuman demonic strength so that nobody could bind him or subdue him. And then night and day among the tombs. So Mark mentions three times that he's among the tombs. Like there are sirens blaring and lights flashing. This man is unclean to the extreme on a Jewish conception of things. What's interesting here, however, is the detail we find in Mark in verse 6. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. That is so crucial. That's a detail we're going to find that happens a number of times in the gospel. We remember what we saw there in chapter 4. Some people are going to be seeing but not perceiving. Some people are going to be hearing but not understanding. And those are outsiders. And the ones who see and perceive and the ones who hear and understand are going to manifest themselves as insiders. And that's what this man does. He sees Jesus from a distance and he ran and fell on his knees. And of course, falling before another character is an indication of worship. And that's something that the disciples never do in Mark's gospel. And it's something that a number of other characters actually do in Mark's gospel. By the way, I've mentioned this before. I read typically with English translations, I'll often consult the NIV and the NASB. The NASB is pretty woodenly literal. And verses 1 to 5 of chapter 5 are one of the places where you can see just how the NIV has sort of tamed down Mark and made it smoother, which is, I really like the NIV, but that's such a disappointment because Mark's language is loaded up to such an extreme that it's obnoxious. And that is intentional. And it's just a bummer that the NIV smooths it out. You get several immediately's and you get some over the top kind of language, you know, constantly night and day, this man is, you know, crying out or whatever. Mark is trying to portray this out of control character dominated by madness and unclean spirits so that he's dwelling among the dead. And the NIV does do that, but sort of, I don't know. I see Mark as this dramatic character who's freaking out audiences with the detail and his exaggerated portrayal. And I see the NIV as sort of making sure that the performance is super polite. Anyway, many, many ways I love the NIV, but that's just kind of a bummer. Anyway, you get this confrontation between Jesus and the unclean spirit. And I want to go into all the detail, but just to note, Jesus has this confrontation. It's sort of a battle. And Jesus, this is hard to read in modern terms, especially when you realize, you know, the intelligence of pigs. But there's a massive destruction that happens here because Jesus casts the demons that are affecting this man into the pigs. And they run down the hillside into the sea and are destroyed. So unfortunately, with modern sensibilities, we sort of see the destruction here. But what, on a first century Jewish conception of things, Jesus has just cleansed this Gentile area. He has liberated this man from demonic possession, and he's purified this area of unclean animals, which is really, really fascinating. And noteworthy, this is the only instance, I think, I'm pretty sure this is the only instance in Mark where Jesus exhorts a character to go and talk about him. And I think that this is because this is in Gentile territory where there's not the presence of all the messianic fever that is going to be present among God's people. And because of that messianic fervor, that is a bunch of people waiting for the liberation of God's people and wanting that to happen in military fashion, that whole dynamic is present in Galilee and Judea, but it's not present in the Gentile area where this miracle takes place, where this liberation of a demonically possessed person takes place. Anyway, this is the first person who is a radical outsider who sees Jesus and responds to him rightly. And again, interestingly, the disciples aren't there. The disciples are present in the next set of episodes that unfold. And here's one of the first places where we get a Markan sandwich. That is, we get one episode wrapped inside of another. In verse 21, all the way down to verse 43, is the account of Jairus, the synagogue official, and his daughter, who is near death. And wrapped inside the middle of that episode is another episode with this woman who touches Jesus's clothing. So this is one of the ways these literary sandwiches, or we can use the polite biblical studies term, an intercalation, to be narratively sophisticated. This is one of these places where we see one of these, and what Mark is doing by embedding a narrative within a narrative is adding to the urgency and the action and the movement and the propulsion forward. And these two narratives have a lot to do with each other. A bunch of details are related to each other. In both instances, there's a daughter. Jairus' daughter is about to die. And it's interesting that Jesus, with the woman, when she is healed, Jesus calls her daughter. And of course, we find out at the end of the episode that the daughter of Jairus is 12 years old, and this woman has been affected by an issue of hemorrhaging, some kind of bleeding issue that has made her ceremonially unclean. This has gone on for 12 years. So there's a couple of correspondences that are very, very interesting. One of the other things that's in common with both of these episodes and the one just previous is the fact that everybody involved here is unclean. Jairus is unclean because he has a dead body in his house. The woman is unclean because she's been bleeding for 12 years. And just like the demonically possessed person was unclean for a variety of reasons that it took Mark 5 verses to talk about. But the dynamic here is intensified because Jesus touches the dead girl, the dead body, making, you know, offending all of the notions of uncleanness that dominated his culture. And the woman touches Jesus, which normally would have made him unclean, but rather brings her healing. So a number of dynamics that are there. But what else is interesting is also in common between the main characters of these episodes and the demonically possessed person. In these two episodes that are sort of enfolded one within the other, we have perception of Jesus and appropriate response. So they get back to the other side of the lake, back on Jewish territory, and this synagogue official, Jairus, in verse 22, when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. Again, perception of Jesus and response of worship. And then he pleads with him he says, my little daughter is about to die. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. Again, which very, very striking when you think about the purity codes or all the notions of cleanness and uncleanness in that culture. So Jesus goes. And another dynamic that we see here, a large crowd followed and pressed around him. So this is one of the first, Jesus had already done this before, I believe. Mark had done this before. the crowd here is an obstacle, becomes an obstacle to Jesus's ministry. And like I said in the last episode, the crowd is a consistent character in Mark, and Mark does not ever make a positive comment about crowds. Sometimes he's ambivalent. Sometimes it's just a neutral comment, but oftentimes Mark will make a negative comment about crowds, which is so fascinating. Again, this is runs counter to expectations of what you're going to find when you read a gospel. And certainly in my, it just rubs against the grain of everything that I was sort of trained to think and feel about prominence and influence as an evangelical. I mean, it's like crowds are, you know, an obvious good, right? Well, again, Mark, the ungospel, wants to play with our expectations and maybe skewer them and subvert them. Anyway, Jesus can't get there because of these crowds. And there's this fascinating character, this woman who has been bleeding for 12 years. And she hears about Jesus, and Mark, the narrator, lets us in on her thinking. And she thinks, if I just touch his clothes, I'll be healed. And immediately, oh, the NIV left one in, verse 29. Immediately, her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. And Jesus, of course, asks, who touched my clothes? Because he felt that this power had gone out from him. Man, all kinds of questions raised by this. Just really crazy details that Mark is giving us. And the disciples are like, Jesus, people are piling on you. How are you talking about somebody who touched you? And then when Jesus keeps looking around to see who had done it, the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet. So she also responds. Let me see. She had, back up in the narrative. Yes, yeah, she, so Jairus saw Jesus. In verse 27, the woman heard about Jesus. So Jairus saw, and that seeing led to perception and proper response. This woman hears, and that hearing leads to understanding and also to proper response. So very, very interesting. The disciples are not people who see. They're not people who hear. They are people who have questions and are confused at what Jesus is all about. Or the confusion is sort of like birthed in the narrative. It's going to increase. Well, the woman, Jesus sends the woman on her way and says, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be free from your suffering. And then some from the house come and say to Jairus, your daughter is dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore. And then Jesus does something really interesting. He goes to the house, and Mark emphasizes that Jesus raises her up and really sort of heals her with his words. But it's like, it's kind of redundant that he touches her, but Mark stresses that because he's sort of skewering and getting us to question the purity codes, or just noting that Jesus is, you know, obliterating the presence of death and of uncleanness. So this is sort of one of the dynamics that we're supposed to understand that in Mark's gospel, where Jesus's presence is, purity is contagious. That runs directly the opposite of the cultural assumptions. Wherever there is impurity, impurity is contagious. You don't want to be around impurity because then you will be ceremonially unclean. But the presence of Jesus runs in exactly the opposite direction, where purity is contagious. And I think that's another dynamic that Mark is getting us to consider, that Mark is inviting us to wonder about our cultural constructions of uncleanness and cleanness. Who do we regard as unclean? Who do we regard as untouchable, as people that will affect us and infect us in some way? Typically, our cultures construct visions of purity by imagining outsiders or others as or strangers as sinners, people that we need to go out and change and bring to repentance, and we and we want to avoid being affected by them or being infected by them in any way. Interestingly, things work exactly in the opposite direction in the Gospel of Mark. And again, I just cannot help but think about some of our political, the dynamics of our political imaginations where we want to demonize or degrade or denigrate others, immigrants, people who think about gender in different ways than we might, and end up sort of developing visions of uncleanness, whereas Mark is, you know, inviting us to revisit all of that. In the next episode, in the beginning of chapter 6, Jesus goes to his hometown, and there's not a whole lot that I want to say about that other than to say it's a shocker that even among his own, Jesus is here actually amazed, and he's amazed at the lack of faith. And because there's no faith present, Jesus is not able to do all that much healing. Then we get this really interesting episode where Jesus sends the 12 on mission. And depending on how you do various aspects of chronologies, I don't know, it's 8 months, 10 months, something like that. But the disciples are sent out on an initial mission to proclaim the kingdom of God, to heal, and to cast out demons. And Mark takes this opportunity to sort of give some background on the death of John the Baptist, which is really interesting, especially if you have just really simplistic notions of, you know, how God works in the world and how things work out. John is this righteous character, and there's a flashback. You know, here Herod hears about all the things that are happening with the mission that the 12 are sent out on. And Jesus's name is becoming well known because of what the disciples are doing, which is a rare note that things are actually going well for the disciples. Their activity causes Jesus's name to become well known. But some people are saying that John the Baptist, that what Jesus, that all this activity is basically a sign that John the Baptist has come back from the dead. And that freaks out Herod, because Herod had put John to death, even though he knew he was a righteous prophet. And one of the things that I think is really interesting here is that Mark portrays, the larger drama that disciples will face in the world as chaotic and capricious. That is to say, righteous John was beheaded because of the foolish, drunken boast of this king and the desire for retaliation on the part of his wife and his stepdaughter in this kind of corrupt marital arrangement. All of that led to John's death. And that's a foreshadowing of what's going to happen at the end of the gospel when Jesus is handed over, when he's arrested, and there's all these unjust machinations that go on with the Jewish leadership and the Roman leadership, and just all this bad stuff sort of goes down, and it ends up with Jesus dying, which in some mysterious ways are according to the plan of God. This is sort of how it has to unfold. But also, this is just sort of not the way that things are supposed to be working. And in line with what happens in Mark 13, that is this ongoing age of destruction following the destruction of the Jerusalem temple, this really leads, I think, audiences of Mark to draw some conclusions about how the world works. Very unlike typical evangelical tradition, which wants to imagine all chaotic events as sort of being in the plan of God, and we want to talk about God's sovereignty as being this kind of dynamic of control, like everything's in control. These are sort of the things that we tend to say to ourselves to kind of pacify our sense that things are actually out of control. The Gospel of Mark does not go there. The Gospel of Mark portrays the unfolding dynamics of this present age as chaotic and capricious and destructive. And for faithful servants of God, you very well may get caught up in the power games of the corrupt royal family and get your head chopped off or be put to death. Go figure. Things are nuts. Nothing is working in this destructive present age like it should. And what's really interesting is Mark has a very shrewd, wise view of unfolding history, whereas I think at least the Christian tradition that I'm familiar with has a very unwise view of history that lacks shrewdness and lacks an ability to actually reckon with things as they are. We want to sort of get up into ideals. All of this is going according to the plan. Well, Mark does not allow that. And that may force a reconfiguring of how you think about a lot of things. But like I've said before, Mark is pretty much forcing reconfiguration on the part of people who say that they are Christian. So as things continue, the disciples, after the death of John, return to Jesus, and some really interesting dynamics unfold here. When the disciples return, Jesus gets them all together, and they report to him all that they had done and taught, which the way that I take that expression is the disciples sort of inappropriately point to themselves rather than point to what God has been doing through them reporting what God has been doing through them and among them. Like I said, when the disciples are initially sent out, what they do in chapter 6, verse 14, what they do results in Jesus's name becoming well known. And when they return to Jesus, they report to them all that they had done and taught. And I think that that is another move that they make that's inappropriate, because what unfolds right after that is a testy exchange between Jesus and the disciples and another major step toward their growing confusion at Jesus. So, they are out and about, and this massive crowd follows them, 5,000 people. They're out there with Jesus, and they don't have any resources. And Mark says that Jesus saw, he looks out on this crowd with compassion. He saw a large, so again, pointing to a verb of perception. When Jesus landed, he saw a large crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. And Mark goes on to say, by this time it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. And it's interesting what the disciples say, which is a massive contrast to what Jesus, or how Jesus feels about the situation. The disciples say, this is a remote place and it's already late. Send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. So Jesus sees the crowds like sheep without a shepherd, and he has compassion. The disciples say, send them away and let them fend for themselves. And Jesus speaks a really tough word to the disciples in verse 37. He says, you give them something to eat. And they respond really badly. They respond with sarcasm. What are you talking about, Jesus? That would take more than a year and a half's worth of wages. How are we going to find anything like that around here? And so Jesus has them find some very meager resources, 5 loaves and 2 fish. And of course, he multiplies this and ends up feeding this massive crowd. And what I think is happening here is Mark's confrontation of the church and its shriveled imagination of living in a world of scarcity instead of living in a world of plenty. Again, I cannot think about this without thinking about our contemporary political situation, where so many conservative white evangelical people will think in terms of politics and think first about wanting to hold on to as much of our stuff as we can. We don't want to be thinking about the common good and how we can see to it that children are fed and people are looked after. All we can think about is holding on to our stuff as much as we possibly can, being wrapped up in tax rates and all the rest. But also on the part of churches, seeing ourselves and the needs of our communities, and sort of, I think this is good for churches to ask themselves, do we see ourselves as people that have plenty and can share, or as people who have to look out for our own and want others to fend for themselves? Well, this is another step in the disciples' growing confusion. They don't want to do what Jesus says to do, but interestingly, Jesus ends up making them servants of the large crowd anyway, because he divides up this food, gives it to the disciples, and the disciples end up passing it on and feeding the large crowd. This next episode, Jesus again, this happens on the sea, and there's some really fascinating stuff going on here. This is the episode in verses 45 down to 56, where Jesus sends the disciples on ahead of them, and this crazy comment that sounds like Jesus is a white middle-class passive-aggressive person, he goes out to out onto the lake to them, walking on the lake, and he was about to pass by them. But when they saw him walking on the lake, they thought he was a ghost, and they cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. A lot of important details there. When Mark says that Jesus was about to pass by them, that is not Jesus giving the disciples the silent treatment and wanting to kind of blow them off as if, you know, you boys don't really mean a whole lot to me, by the way. What is happening there is, this is where some of the details of the scriptural narratives from the Old Testament are really important. When God reveals himself to strategic servants of his, he will pass by. And there's this wonderful passing by tradition from the Old Testament. You remember when Moses asked God to show him his glory, and God put Moses sort of in the crag of a rock and passed by him, proclaiming his name. That is, he was revealing himself to Moses. And God later did the very same thing to Elijah. He passed by Elijah to reveal himself to Elijah, to sort of strengthen him to continue on on his mission. And we get passages like this in Job, where Job talks about God's revelation of himself as the wave treader. He's the one who walks on the water. And here we have Jesus walking on the water, passing by the disciples in an effort to reveal himself to them. And that's what Job talks about. He talks in poetic fashion. He talks about God, the wave treader, and when he passes by, he is unknowable, because he's sort of, you can't get your head around this God. He reveals himself, but he's sort of beyond knowledge. And all of that is going into this episode. Jesus is wanting to reveal himself to his disciples, but when they see him, their seeing doesn't lead to perception, it leads to fear. So something is going wrong with the disciples. In this very same episode, they're completely amazed, and Mark makes a very interesting comment, for they had not understood about the loaves, their hearts were hardened. So they are not learning the lesson from what Jesus just did with the multiplication of the loaves, but rather their hearts are hardened. And that taps into a very rich and massive biblical tradition with Pharaoh hardening his heart, God hardening Pharaoh's heart, and Israel manifesting themselves as a disobedient people with hardened hearts. That very same dynamic is happening to the disciples. Something is going wrong. What is the deal? The people closest to Jesus are growing increasingly confused, while other people are growing in understanding. And This next episode, as chapter 7 opens, all I'm going to say about this is that Jesus, in conversation with the Pharisees, radically reconfigures cleanness and uncleanness. Cleanness and uncleanness, that is nearness to God or distance from God, has nothing to do with what a person eats or washes, goes through ceremonies and all that kind of stuff. It has everything to do with the core of a person. That's what determines nearness to God and distance from God. And right after that reconfiguration of cleanness and uncleanness, we come to this provocative episode with the Syrian Phoenician woman with the demon-possessed daughter. One of the most mystifying episodes in the Gospel of Mark, and really this one also is included in the Gospel of Matthew, and very, very challenging, which I think I've hinted at what's happening here before, but in line with everything that's been said, I think all of that explains what's happening here. So Jesus goes to the vicinity of Tyre, which I think for first century Jewish audiences would have been mystifying. Why would he go to heavily, heavily Gentile territory again? And especially when he goes there, he enters a house. Why would he enter a house? That's going into sort of the heart of uncleanness. And Mark makes the interesting comment, he did not want anyone to know of it. And I can imagine a Jewish audience hearing this in the first century thinking, well, yeah, of course. I mean, what he's doing is scandalous, right? But of course, he can't keep his presence a secret. And pay attention to the narrative details here in verse 25. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, so this here's a person who is, we're going to find out, is unclean, but she hears and responds appropriately in the same way that Jairus and the bleeding woman and the demon-possessed man did a few chapters earlier. Mark says, as soon as she heard about him, so a verb of perception, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an impure spirit came and fell at his feet. So she hears, that hearing leads to understanding and drives appropriate response to Jesus. And then Mark loads up the uncleanness talk. So not only does she have an impure spirit living in her house and her daughter possessed by this impure spirit, but she's a Gentile and she's mixed race. And she is begging Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. Another place where the NIV sort of skews things slightly wrongly. She is constantly begging. Is the verb here. She's constantly begging Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. And Jesus is telling her this insulting response. So this is kind of an ongoing dialogue of her badgering Jesus and Jesus putting her off. And he says, first let the children eat all they want, for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. That's right. He calls her a dog. And in the first century world, dogs are not cute pets. In the first century Mediterranean world, dogs are not cuddly pets. They're unclean animals. And he gives her the toughest word possible, this mystifying word, this offensive statement, sort of just like Jesus had given a real tough statement to the disciples just earlier. And they responded badly. They responded to Jesus with sarcasm. And their hearts grow hardened. This woman, though, responds totally appropriately. And it's not merely that she adopts the posture of humility, like, yes, I am an unclean dog. I think that it's the fact that Jesus speaks to her a mystifying statement, a parable, a riddle. And she responds with a shrewd riddle. And she says, Lord, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And basically, she is just the absolute all-star of Mark 4-8 because she is the most cultivated soil. She gets the toughest word that Jesus gives in the entire gospel, and she responds appropriately, and not appropriately by demeaning herself, but by responding with a parable. because Jesus actually highlights the parable in his response. He says, then he told her, for such a word, for such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter. So he, in this instance, there's an exorcism performed from a distance, but just so cool. Unlike the disciples, she responds very appropriately to Jesus, and for that, she gets what she has come to Jesus for, which is really interesting. Well, as Mark 8 opens up, we get a second feeding, and this is really interesting. Mark is not a foolish narrator who forgot that he already put a feeding miracle in his gospel. This is in here to sort of highlight just how far the disciples have fallen and are not getting what Jesus is all about. This is kind of a really interesting open. There's another crowd that gathers, and the way that Mark narrates this, it's almost like Jesus is trying to lead the disciples along to actually perform well in this instance. And Mark says, since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said. Now, Jesus here like thinks out loud. And I read him as sort of saying, all right, look, boys, same situation we just faced. I'm looking on these people with compassion. Here's what I'd love to see happen. Now, shouldn't you go ahead and he's trying to lead them to act. He says, I have compassion for these people. They've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come from a long distance. And I think that he's setting them up to actually do well here. But they respond by saying, where in this remote place is anybody going to get enough bread to feed these people? Oh, guys, have you learned nothing? Answer, no, they've not learned anything. And the very, very same thing happens. Jesus ends up providing, and he ends up providing through the sort of inadvertent service of the disciples. And this whole long stretch of text ends up coming to a conclusion in verses 14 to 21, when everything sort of, after this feeding miracle, the disciples are going to get back into the boat with Jesus and return home. And when they get back in the boat, Jesus says to them, be careful, watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. Now, this is, in a sense, a parable. That is, it's just a saying. But in another sense, it's not really a parable. It's just a very clear statement. And they get the imagery. Like, you know, what yeast does, it's a small amount that you put in to bread that affects the whole of it. And it's usually negative, but not always in Jewish sayings, in sort of parabolic statements. But here, it's negative. There are these negative dynamics, that the negative attributes that the Pharisees have, guys, and negative aspects to Herod's character. Watch out for those negative aspects. That's all he's saying. And the disciples say, I think he's talking about bread. Yeah, I think it's because we don't have any bread with us. And Jesus, aware of what they're saying, asks, why are you talking about having no bread? I'm not talking about bread. I'm talking about yeast affecting a whole lump. And here is where he sort of is fed up with these guys and confronts them with the reality that they are the ones manifesting themselves as outsiders. They are the ones who are seeing but not understanding. They're the ones who have hardened hearts, who have eyes but fail to see, who have ears but fail to hear. And he asks, like, haven't you learned anything from what you have seen? From my feeding of the 5,000 and then the subsequent feeding, and the fact that there was all of this left over. And he says, do you still not understand? So I think that this is a fascinating long section in which everything that you expect to happen doesn't happen. And what you don't expect to happen happens. Again, Mark is a master narrator. He's a master of surprise. Everything is upside down in Mark's story world. And the conclusion that I think Christian audiences are supposed to draw is we are not seeing things rightly. It might be us. We might be the ones who don't understand. We might be the ones who are seeing but not perceiving and hearing but not understanding. We just might be the ones who need to have our imaginations radically reconfigured. And I think that in this, there's a challenge to confessing Christians to examine and to self-examine and to wonder whether we really get Jesus and whether we are really attending to what we should be doing, attending to what Jesus has said to do, to be people that welcome the marginalized, that go to the other, that forge relationships of solidarity and mutuality and friendship, and enjoy the hospitality that Jesus has to offer to all of us. And are we involved in acts of self-abandoning service to others as communities seeking to serve the world in the name of Jesus? Or have we grown complacent? Have we grown selfish? Have we grown selfish and grasping and holding on to our own and not imagining that we actually live in the world of plenty that constitutes God's good creation? And further, I think it's this section of Mark 4-8 is a real challenge for us to re-examine what being a disciple looks like. How has our Christian culture constructed the quote-unquote ideal disciple? I mentioned two popular evangelical figures earlier on this podcast, and they have been architects of a certain kind of masculine idealization of discipleship. Conservative evangelical culture has set at the center white males. They are the ideal disciples, and others sort of take their places around white males, and everything is sort of seen through the white male gaze. Well, Mark 4-8 is inviting us to re-examine that. How have we constructed what disciples look like? Because in Mark 4-8, the disciples, the official term, the 12, are not being disciples. They are bad examples of what disciples should be. They're not listening to Jesus. And these other characters, they are being disciples. Jairus and the woman and the demon-possessed man and especially the Syrian Phoenician woman. So audiences are supposed to note all of this and respond by asking, how do our imaginations need to be radically reconceived so that we don't imagine discipleship in terms that are problematic, but in terms that are inviting? Like the Pharisees at the beginning of Mark 7, evangelical Christian culture has come up with culturally constructed notions of cleanness and uncleanness. We have notions of who is near to God and who is far from God. And we have used the Bible to construct those, usually having to do with sexuality and gender and race and ethnicity. And these are fault lines that are highly, fundamentally problematic. And Mark skewers all of that by moving just after that discussion that Jesus has with the Pharisees to the Syrian Phoenician woman. So race and gender are being reconfigured. So lots to think about there. Lots to think about with the Gospel of Mark. Anyway, that's Mark 4-8. Fascinating narrative dynamics that leave us with a lot for reflection. Well, this is episode 17. Now time to edit it, get it in the books. By the time it's aired, it'll be election day. Who knows what we're going to find out? All we know is it'll be a day for us to seek joy and to love our neighbors. And as far as the forecast goes, like today, it is supposed to be here in West Michigan anyway, a beautiful day. Don't let it get away.